Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 22nd of January. This story was perhaps eclipsed by all that was going on in Washington this week, but it's just a fascinating story that was released over the weekend from Sydney. A deep-sea submarine exploration off Australia's southern coast has discovered new species of animals and more evidence of the destructive impact of the greenhouse gas carbon dioxide on deep-sea corals. This was a scientific voyage by U.S. and Australian researchers, and it explored a near vertical slice in the Earth's crust, which drops from approximately 1.2 miles to more than 2.5 miles deep. One of the researchers said, "We set out to search for life deeper than any previous voyage in Australian waters, and the sampling documented the deepest known Australian fauna, including a bizarre carnivorous sea squirt, sea spiders, and giant sponges in previously unknown marine communities dominated by gooseneck barnacles and millions of round, purple-spotted sea anemones." We're going to be talking about all that was found and the good news and bad news for the oceans this hour of our program with one of the scientists who was at the head of this expedition. Dr. Jess Adkins is with us, Associate Professor of Geochemistry and Global Environmental Science at the California Institute of Technology. He is a chemical oceanographer interested in using trace metals as tracers of environmental processes, and most of his current work is centered around the geochemical investigation of past climates, concerned with the last few glacial-interglacial cycles that span a mere few hundred thousand years. He's with us this hour, Dr. Adkins, and we're going to welcome phone calls about this fascinating expedition. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. Dr. Adkins, thank you so much for being with us.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Sure. When did you and your Australian cohorts decide that this was the part of the ocean that you wanted to examine?
Let's see. When did I decide?
When
I was about 5 years old, maybe.
That's a question I didn't mean to ask, but I love the answer to it. When you were five, why this part of the ocean? Why right here?
The Southern Ocean. So the part of the ocean that has no continents that interrupt it, going north south. So it's an open fetch all the way around the planet. Is one of the most important areas to think about in terms of climate change, both on the long terms, the kind of thing that I think about a lot every day, and the shorter term, what's coming in the next 10 or 20 years with our climate future.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so the reason for that is several fold, and perhaps it's something we can get into over the course of the conversation here.
Yeah, sure. So this was a joint venture. You and Australia, the United States and Australia, did this collaboratively?
That's correct. This was something that, after doing similar sort of work in the North Atlantic with the submersible Alvin out of the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution back in 2003, we realized that we only had one piece of the story by looking at the North Atlantic, and we very much needed to get to the Southern Ocean to try and find at least one other piece of the story. Whether or not it's the other half, we'll have to find out, I suppose. And so I began thinking about that around that time, 2003 or 2004, and then 2 years ago at a meeting, 2.5 years ago at a meeting in Miami, I sat down with my colleague Ron Thresher, and he said, "Look, I think there are lots of these fossil corals out south of Tasmania on the southern coast of Australia." And I said, "Well, let's bring some U.S. assets down there to try and look at them." And that's where the idea was hatched, basically sitting over lunch at this meeting.
Oh, isn't that something? How great ideas have their origins. That's wonderful. And now you were looking at, tell me about these little machine guys. I almost think of them as people. It's sort of a robot thing that's probing the depth, and it was way down there, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's absolutely right, yes. It's one of several tools we have here in the U.S. to explore the deep ocean, and we, as a maritime nation, are lucky to have things that can go so deep. This particular one is a remotely operated vehicle, or an ROV, not to be confused with a human-occupied vehicle, or an HOV, or an autonomous underwater vehicle, an AUV, right? That what's life without some acronyms like this? So this ROV is exactly as you said. It's a robot, but there are no humans inside of it. We sit up on the ship in a control van, and there's a tether that runs the couple miles down to the vehicle, carrying power and data back and forth on copper wires and fiber optics down the cable.
And what did you find? What did you see?
We saw the bottom of the ocean.
Wow. You saw the bottom of the ocean. Isn't that great just to say that? We saw the bottom of the ocean.
Yeah, it's in fact absolutely fantastic, right? There are moments when you're sitting in the chair and there's lots of decisions to be made and a bank of 25 monitors in front of you. And you just have to take a moment, sit back, take a deep breath, and just take it in. I mean, there are these transcendent moments on the seafloor where you're flying over some of the more beautiful structures you're ever going to see. And it's breathtaking, I think, is what it's like.
Mm. And it makes you think, huh, I thought about this when I was 5. Here I am doing this.
Yeah, I guess I really thought about doing it when I first was in graduate school back in the early 90s and started working on these deep-sea corals and started to make it a goal to try and get down and see what it looked like, where they were growing, and were there better ways to go and pick them up than picking through the collections of dredges that I was doing as a graduate student.
Hmm. Yep. And the deep-sea corals that, maybe I got this wrong, they were like 10,000 years old, the ones that are way, way down there?
So that's right. So we have, from last year's expedition, this was actually a two-cruise trip. We went last year in January as well with an Australian vessel and one of these autonomous underwater vehicles. So a robot that you program ahead of time, kick over the side, and it goes down and makes maps and takes pictures, but it can't bring any of the samples home. This trip was all about bringing the samples home. And we saw a bunch of the corals on that first trip. And so with this one, we wanted to go and pick them up.
And you found that they were in good shape way down and not as good higher up? Or what was that story?
Well, that's right. So there is, I think, a still evolving story here. There are several aspects of it that are very cool. And I can actually get back to your question about how old they are with this. Let's see. We work in my lab on the history of the Earth's climate, and we'd like to understand why climate changes in the past happened, why they happened, how they happened, to better understand what's going to happen in the future. Mm-hmm. And so we're quite hopeful that there are corals down there that are 10,000, 20,000, or 40,000 years old. That doesn't mean that they've lived for that long. That just means they lived for about 100 years ago, that many years in the past. When we did this in the North Atlantic, we found a wide distribution of ages going back to 100,000 years or so. And we still don't really know what we're going to find out of this expedition. But from last year's trip, when we took a few off the bottom with a dredge, one of them was 20,000 years old and one of them was 11,000 years old.
Mm-hmm. And where did you find significant problems as you're looking at the history of the Earth's climate and the reason for changes in the climate? Did you make any scientific advancement in terms of carbon dioxide having a significant effect recently on corals?
I think that we had a very interesting observation that it's going to require us to look at these ages a little bit more closely before we know for sure. But the story is really very straightforward in what could be happening. And that is, as CO2 goes up in the atmosphere, because we're taking it out of the rocks, we're burning fossil fuels and putting it into the atmosphere, that's taken the ocean and the atmosphere system out of equilibrium or out of its steady state, and it's such that now carbon dioxide wants to go into the ocean. Well, that CO2 is an acid, and it takes the pH of the ocean and makes it a little bit lower. It makes the ocean more acidic. The corals are actually quite sensitive to that ocean pH. And the surface corals especially, so things like the Great Barrier Reef, and if you go on vacation in the Caribbean, something I suggest you do, you'll see these beautiful coral reefs that are under all sorts of different impacts of pollution and disease and ocean acidification. The deep sea corals are more likely under just the ocean acidification stress, though the time that it'll take the CO2 to get there will be a little bit longer. And that's one of the things we were looking to see if we could see any evidence of.
Mm-hmm. And you did?
Yes, in a sense. This, I think, sparked a good debate on board. My colleague Ron Thresher in Australia and I aren't exactly on the same page on this debate yet, but I think we have the way forward to try and resolve it.
Oh, really?
It. Yes. So we saw something quite interesting, which is that of the species of coral, of a particular kind of coral, scleractinia, that's just a word, right, that's used to confuse everybody. but they're the same kind of corals that you see in the Great Barrier Reefs, the big brain corals or the branching acroporas. These are all scleractinia, and they're some of the same kinds of ones down in the deep ocean. One of the major reef-forming versions of them, this one called Solanismilia, we always saw dead coral as we came from deeper and came up shallower. We found dead coral before we found living.
Hmm.
Now, that's not that surprising. What we did see at the same time is that on an individual colony where there was a little bit of living near the top, it looked like the that it had died relatively recently as you moved down down the individual coral. And then you could go to other heads that from our video looked like they were alive, and yet when we brought them back up to the boat, it was clear that there weren't living polyps on them. The animal wasn't alive.
Mm-hmm.
And that made us wonder, when did that happen? And if that happened relatively recently, then I think that that's a that CO2 was on the table for sure. The ocean acidification is on the table for sure about that.
Mm-hmm.
If it happened 10,000 years ago, then CO2 is not on the table.
Oh.
And we can't do the dating out at sea. We have to do that back here in the lab at Caltech. And so it's time for us to get on our horse.
So when would you know the answer to that?
Well, that will take the first indication we'll have will be in the next few months, where we will try to take some of the pieces that we brought off the boat and quickly get an idea of the age distribution. Are they all 500 years old and nothing from the last glacial maximum, 20,000 years ago? Are they all from the glacial period and very little coming up towards today? We saw tons and tons and tons of fossil material while we were down there. And the question is, what's its age distribution? Even over time, or does it feel climate as it goes along?
Hmm.
And if so, does it feel climate recently, or does it feel climate in the past?
Hmm.
The North Atlantic, we already know the vote on that one.
And what is the vote on that again?
That was fascinating. The North Atlantic clearly feels the same rapid climate changes that were being recorded in the ice cores. So there's this somewhat famous story now of the Greenland ice cores coming up in the early 90s, and showing us that the scale of climate change in the past and the time scales of climate change were much faster and much larger than we had ever realized from just looking at marine sediments. And one of the things that the deep sea corals help us do is try to match that same time scale in the deep ocean. And one of the things we've done over the last few years is show that by making chemical measurements in the skeletons, you can see those same sorts of rapid climate changes in the deep ocean. The really exciting thing over the last few months is we've gotten more and more dates from the North Atlantic. It's not just the chemistry in the skeletons, it's the community themselves that are responding to these rapid climate changes. They prefer times when the climate is going through very rapid shifts. These all get names in the past, things like the Younger Dryas and Heinrich events. But really the main point is that when the ice cores show that there's a big jump in climate, that's when we see the pulses of corals in the North Atlantic. And I'm really interested to know if that pattern exists in the Southern Ocean also.
Mm-hmm. It is remarkable how you're making such strides in this area in the last few years, isn't it? I mean, even in the last year or two.
Yeah, it is really fun to be in this field right now. First of all, I mean, you get out of bed in the morning thinking, okay, got to go find this out today because it's going to matter for tomorrow. And that always helps. And second is, it's just cool. I mean, the problem itself is incredibly important, and the things you need to worry about are the physics and the biology and the chemistry of the ocean, and you need to understand the geology to be able to go find the corals. I mean, what could be more fun than working on it all at once?
Right. And you have found a lot of new marine species. Tell me about this, because it made so much press, this strange carnivorous sea squirt, and we've seen pictures of it. What an odd-looking animal.
Yeah, it is an amazing one. It's straight out of Dr. Seuss.
It is, right, yeah.
In fact, there's tons of this stuff that is very Seussian in that way. I think one of the cool things is one of these transcendent moments I mentioned before was when we were just flying over a pristine version of these reefs. Some of these reefs have been quite heavily fished in the last 10 or 15 years, but we did manage to find some seamounts that had totally pristine versions. And we just let the submarine fly over them, taking our video as we went, and it goes on for hundreds and hundreds of meters, going on half a mile, almost a mile in some cases, along the tops of these seamounts, and it looks like one of the more beautiful English gardens, right, that you would come across, or here at the Huntington Gardens right here in Pasadena. And yet you have to remind yourself that everything down there eats, right? There's not a single bit of plant life in the whole thing. And then as you get closer, you realize that these shapes are incredibly bizarre and cool, the stalked crinoids and carnivorous sea squirts. And then you get even closer, and you realize that it's not actually this sort of benign and beautiful place. It's actually a harsh environment and quite malevolent. We had one really amazing sort of inadvertent experience with this where we were trying to sample a mollusk, so just like a little clamshell, with the manipulator arm. And the shell turned out to be much more fragile than we realized. We were picking one of several dozen that were around, and we cracked the shell with the manipulator. And within seconds, these very nice-looking sea stars that had just been sort of draped over some of the corals went into dive-bomb mode. And they went crashing down towards this newly opened-up bit of organic matter, right? This animal that now didn't have its protective shell and was open to predation. And the sea stars came falling by about half dozen of them within seconds. It was amazing.
Oh, my.
And just a little bit creepy, I have to admit.
Yeah, I would imagine.
Yeah, it really changed your mind instantly, like, about just what a tough life it might be down there.
Right. And what is the – we had an email, people wondering about the water pressure. What's it like down that far, and how do the creatures keep from imploding?
You know, that's a neat question. Yeah, I mean, within the top 10 meters of the ocean, you feel the entire air pressure of the whole atmosphere above you. And so any deeper you go than 10 meters, and we were down at 4,000 meters, right, you have much, much higher pressures. But animals really care about the difference in pressure, not so much the absolute pressure, right? The animals make a shell or they have a membrane, and all that really matters is what pressure gradient they have to support. How much pressure is on the outside and how much pressure is on the inside. For us, it's a big problem because we have lungs, right? So we always have some air trapped inside of us. And that's what gets crushed, and that's the big problem. If you don't have lungs, you can go as deep as you like.
Oh.
Yeah. Huh. So they don't seem to do very well when we bring them back to the surface. One thing we tried to do was keep a little aquarium running.
Uh-huh.
And pull them back up and put them into the aquarium at the right temperature and turn off the lights. And they sort of limped along for the couple of weeks that we were out there. But they clearly weren't as happy as they were down on the seafloor. I don't really understand why that is yet.
How do you determine happiness on the part of one of these creatures?
You call them up and ask them on a radio interview.
Let's welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour is Dr. Jess Adkins, Associate Professor of Geochemistry and Global Environmental Science at the California Institute of Technology. And we're talking about this remarkable four-week expedition exploring the deep ocean southwest of Tasmania, revealing new species of animals and also adding to the research that our guest has been doing for some time of the impacts of increasing carbon dioxide on deep sea corals. And you can also, we'll ask him, people are calling and wondering where you can see pictures of this. We'll ask him that in a moment. You've probably seen some of the pictures of this carnivorous sea squirt, but there are places where you can see more too, which is, it might be nice to listen to the conversation and go to the internet and see the pictures simultaneously. Our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, that address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're welcoming phone calls on this scientific submarine making deep sea discoveries, this remarkable journey, 4-week expedition to explore the deep ocean southwest of Tasmania. And it was looking at a couple things and then found things that are unexpected, new species of animals and also the impacts of increasing carbon dioxide on deep sea corals. Those studies are underway right now, the second part of that, and more studies of the animals as well. Our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Before we go to phone calls, talk a little bit more about, we talked about some of what you saw, this carnivorous sea squirt, but you also saw sea spiders, giant sponges, and previously unknown marine communities, didn't you?
Absolutely, yeah. I think that's one of the really great things about having these deep submergence technologies in the U.S. is that we have not looked in the deep ocean at all, right? We have discovered these hydrothermal vents, and we go back there a lot to figure out how they work, and that's fantastically cool. But there is 99% of the seafloor or more still left to explore. And I think one of the main points of this is if you go and look somewhere where no one's looked before, you're going to find new things. And that, of course, happened to us. It's fantastic when it does, but I don't know that it's actually that surprising. I mean, there is so much out there still to learn about the bottom of the ocean. It's almost daunting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And probably questions that you don't know. When you look at the bottom of the ocean, when you talked about having these questions when you were five, are you immediately thinking all kinds of questions that you never thought that you would ask because there are new things there?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I'm a chemist by training and didn't really know a whole lot about oceanography before I got into graduate school. And so I'm still really trying to learn about some of the biological interactions.
Mm-hmm.
And that has been so cool. I mean, you go down and you see time and time again the same sort of associations that you see that this particular kind of coral always has one sea star on it, or you see one of these really beautiful glass sponges that's 50 centimeters or a meter long, a big long tube, and there are two shrimps living inside of it, a male and a female, and it's totally sealed off on the top. The only way they could have gotten in there is as larvae. They've lived their entire life inside this glass sponge. It's just stunning.
It is
the niches that are filled in the different places on the planet.
Yeah.
It's really fantastic.
And where are all the pictures? I've seen some of them on the internet. Is there a place to go where people, while they're listening to you, can find these?
So I think there is. I think if you go to the CSIRO webpage, so that's C-S-I-R-O, that is the National Research Organization in Australia. And if you just Google on CSIRO and Hobart, as in the town in Tasmania, and coral, you will get this page to come up relatively quickly. We're also here at Caltech looking to set up a web page with a press release and some of the other pictures that we took while we were down there.
Mm-hmm.
I literally got off the plane about 36 hours ago. So.
Oh, did you really? Oh, I didn't realize it. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
This is very recent then.
Yeah, absolutely. And the first order was to visit with my 2-year-old and 5-year-old a little bit.
Oh, I'm sure. And won't they love to see the pictures as well?
Yeah. Well, they were happy to see Dad on it.
Yeah, that's true. I forgot about Dad. That's true.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
Let's go to some phone calls. Michael from Madison. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how are you, Kathleen?
Fine, how are you?
Real good.
Good.
Hey, I lived in San Diego for many years, and I was an avid scuba diver. Through the years, I've seen a serious decline in clams and scallops and lobsters and such. One of the things I was aware of while I was there is that when I was a young man, they closed the beaches one afternoon, and they were closed for about 2 weeks, and I looked into it, and I found the cause to be a broken sewage line that ran out into the ocean. And it was broken about halfway out, and they needed to repair that. Well, then my question came was, well, why are we dumping stuff into the ocean? Well, supposedly, the sewage is being treated, and the sewage line goes out many, many thousands of yards, I guess, and over to a shelf that drops off into the abyss. Are we causing damage to that area by doing this sort of thing throughout this country?
So that's a really interesting question and certainly important in coastal oceanography. And I think that at the heart of why these sorts of sewer lines are put in and out into the ocean is sort of summed up by the solution to pollution is dilution. I think folks may have heard that before.
Yeah.
And, of course, what we call dilution in 30 years ago turns out not to be so 30 years on sometimes, and that's the kind of thing that's happening. It's happening right here in Los Angeles as well with the Hyperion sewage plant. Absolutely, there are beach closures all over Southern California from time to time, usually due to these bacterial outbreaks, and there's in fact become very good grassroots networks for monitoring these, which have then gotten the public agencies involved, and so now you can go to web pages each day and say, okay, how clean are the beaches these days?
Yeah.
In terms of, is this the right thing to be doing? Well, we make sewage. That's part of what we are as a species and as a civilization, and we need to figure out what to do with our waste. I think that the deep ocean isn't such a terrible place to be putting that. The deep ocean has a natural nutrient cycle of plants living in the surface, taking nitrates and phosphates out of the surface, fixing them into their organic matter using light, that's photosynthesis, and then dying and sinking into the deep. And the idea behind these sewer pipes is that we're just tapping into that. But of course, we could think about doing this better now that we know much more about the bacteria that are associated with these. Michael, is that a helpful answer to your question or not?
To a certain degree, I guess. I always.
We can't hear you very well, Michael.
System of constant turnover. You know, I mean, no matter what you do, it's always a cycle. And I just see us as being polluters when we're damaging the bottoms of the oceans. That's going to affect the tops of the oceans and the fish and everything else that's connected to that. And I was just curious to see what your thoughts on it were.
Yeah, absolutely. We put things out of sight and think that they're not doing anything, and then you go look a little bit closer and realize that they are. But you can't take these sorts of these problems out of the context of what do you do with the waste anyway. These are real problems that we've looked to the ocean for a long time. We certainly have done damage to the ocean with these kinds of things. The coral reefs in the Caribbean are an excellent example. And the beaches in Southern California are a very public example of it because so many folks like going to the nice beaches there.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for the call, Michael. We have lines open if you'd like to join the conversation. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, you can do that as well. That is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Our guest just returned from the scientific voyage by U.S. and Australian researchers who set out to search for life deeper than any previous voyage in Australian waters and looking at the deepest known fauna and finding some creatures they didn't know existed, and also looking, our guest particularly this hour, at the impact of carbon dioxide on coral reefs and looking at previous cycles of warming of the ocean and coming up with, you know, no small task, a history of climate change and what carbon dioxide might be doing to speed a global warming process in the oceans now. So it's fascinating. And the study was, well, they've spent a lot of time preparing for it, but I didn't realize it's literally 36 hours from leaving that part of the world to now begin the laboratory work of what they found and examining all that they found, which is a lot. 800-486-8655 is the number. Can you give me a little better understanding, Dr. Atkins, of what the sources of carbon dioxide are that are affecting, that we know are affecting coral reefs already? Where is all this coming from?
Right, that's unquestioned. We know that for sure, and that's because of our activities of burning fossil fuels. Driving cars around, moving goods and service goods around on the planet is putting more CO2 into the atmosphere than what was there before the Industrial Revolution. That's an unequivocal result that is basically just data. And it's a little bit like a can of Coca-Cola, actually, if you think about it, right? So you open up your can of Coke and it pops because there's CO2 dissolved in the Coke. The reason the CO2 comes popping out is that the Coca-Cola is at a pH of about 2 or so. It's very acidic. And so most of the carbon that is stored in that Coca-Cola, that inorganic carbon, is as the acidic form, which is carbon dioxide gas and carbonic acid. If you were to add some base back to that Coca-Cola, if you were to bring the pH up to something like pH 7, it wouldn't pop when you opened up the top. And that's much more like what the ocean is like. That because most of the carbon is not as carbonic acid, but as bicarbonate, which is just like that Arm & Hammer bacon soda that you put in your refrigerator to keep the odors down.
Right.
Or as carbonate ion, the basic form, which is what the corals use to make their skeleton, and it's what the limestone cliffs are that when you walk along the river are made out of. Neither of those feel the gaseous species. Neither of those put CO2 back out. It's only the acidic one. And so as you make things more basic, you get more of the carbonate ion and less of the gas one. And so the natural cycle of CO2 going up and down in the atmosphere is very much tied to the ocean's pH, because there's 60 times more carbon in the ocean than there is in the atmosphere. What's happened in the last 150, 200 years or so is we've perturbed that cycle by taking carbon out of rocks, out of fossil fuel reservoirs, and putting it directly into the atmosphere. And so that's taking the acidic species and putting it into the atmosphere, and it is definitely coming back into the ocean. There's just no doubt about that. Mm-hmm. The doubts come down to the rates and their effects.
Hmm.
So when this was first talked about a few years ago as affecting coral reefs, I was actually quite skeptical, even though I work very closely on corals, because one of the things we work on is how do the corals make their skeleton? What is this biomineralization process? And they quite closely control the pH of the environment where they make their skeleton. And it always seemed to me that they were able to manipulate the pH to much more so than the small changes, or what seem like small changes, that would be happening from atmospheric CO2 increases. However, some studies have really changed my mind about that, and they're basic, straightforward studies where you just grew corals under different CO2 concentrations. And for all of those corals that were growing under CO2 concentrations that are out of equilibrium, so higher CO2 than what they would have had pre-industrial, the corals grew more slowly. They made less skeleton, even to the point in some cases where you got to very acidic situations where they stopped growing completely. Well, those very acidic ones are ones that we're headed towards right now. And so even though I was skeptical that the corals could feel this so sensitively, when you put them in the lab, they clearly do.
Hmm.
And that's really opened my eyes to the sensitivity of both these deep and these surface ones.
Mm-hmm.
Changed my mind just from new data.
Hmm. Let's go to Robert from Stevens Point. Hi, Robert.
Hello. Yes, I was wondering, in the process of your investigations, have you found any sea life that was prehistoric sea life, that which was previously thought to have been extinct, sort of like the coelacanths, or anything similar?
We didn't find any coelacanths, though that would have been cool. I totally agree. In fact,
I mean something similar.
Yeah, I was in Indonesia in 1998 and had just been with the group that months later they found those coelacanths and was quite jealous. we were always joking as we went diving down there that we would find Archituthis, this giant squid that occasionally comes up in fishing nets but's never really been seen swimming in situ, that can, you know, be 30 feet long. Instead, we just got attacked by sharks.
Ooh.
You know, just regular old deep-sea sharks coming down at one point and really getting angry at the vehicle and coming
Whoa,
in.
Oh, what did
and,
you do?
And biting at it. Well, I was trying to keep everybody focused on the invertebrates, right? We're there for the corals, but, you know, sharks capture everybody's imagination. And so the control van went crazy, like, they're getting us!
Oh, no!
Right? It was a pretty funny time.
Ooh, pretty scary, I would think.
Yep.
Robert, anything else?
Well, I didn't literally mean a coelacanth. I meant anything that, like the coelacanth, was thought to have been extinct, but is now...
Yeah, that's right, Robert. No, I didn't really answer your question. I just wanted to talk about sharks.
Oh, okay.
So the short answer to your question is no. We did not find any species that had thought to be extinct. We did find things that we didn't even know were species. So you can't know that they were extinct if you didn't know they existed at all. But we didn't find any remnants or refugia of something that we previously thought didn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
We did find lots and lots of what we call fossil coral. We did find skeletons of coral that clearly grew a long time in the past, but there are modern examples of it growing today.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
All right. Thanks very much for your call.
Thank you.
Lines open for you if you'd like to join our conversation. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And our guest, who is just back from this remarkable journey to off the coast of Tasmania, Dr. Jess Adkins, Associate Professor of Geochemistry and Global Environmental Science at the California Institute of Technology. You're listening to him talk about the journey here on the Ideas Network, and it's, you know, this, I guess you could say, fairly surreal world of the deep ocean, and they went way down with their robot explorer discovering new marine species and sea squirt and deep coral reefs, and it's quite something. They're looking at a part of the ocean that we haven't seen before and gone farther down off the coast of Australia than anybody's ever gone before. So now what does it all mean? Now they're doing tests on what they found. And looking specifically, our guest, because of his background at global climate change. More phone calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Dr. Jess Adkins, our guest, and our number 800-486-8655, an email that has come in. Dr. Adkins, I recall in the 1950s that atomic waste particles and concrete-laden oil cans were dumped into the Atlantic Ocean. Do you know what effects that dumping may have had?
So we definitely can see the results of atmospheric nuclear weapons tests in the oceans. The specifics of a particular dump I don't know about, but you certainly can find in the sediments where people have dumped the remnants of some of these radioactive species. The atmospheric nuclear testing has left a really interesting imprint on the ocean. It's one of the ways we actually get to use terrible catastrophes as tracers in oceanography. So many of these radionuclides, these radioactive species, one of them being carbon-14, were created in great excess to what they normally exist on in the atmosphere. And that tracer of what we call bomb radiocarbon, or bomb-produced C-14, has made its way from the atmosphere into the upper ocean and is slowly making its way into the deep ocean. But it's a little bit like adding blue dye to the surface of the ocean and being able to watch where does it go first and how fast does it go. And so it's a fantastic tracer of the rate of ocean circulation, trying to use a terrible catastrophe to at least learn something interesting about the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Chris is next from Colfax. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
Hi.
Wondering about, I don't want to get off the topic, but shipwrecks. Like, how deep did you see any shipwrecks? And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right,
so
Chris.
I can hear you better.
Okay.
No, shipwrecks are absolutely fascinating. And certainly one of the tools that, one of the things that these ROVs have done, one of the great projects for these tools, is investigating past shipwrecks. This is not a major shipping region. As you might imagine, it's the roaring 40s, and so no one wants to go there. We bounced around ourselves. The weather was terrible. We lost about half of our days just to weather. We did, however, find a lot of fishing gear in places that we knew had been fished as a deep fishery, mostly for this species orange roughy and to some degree for these Oreo dories. Where the fish like to congregate around the tops of the seamounts, and those seamounts that came up shallow enough, I hope seamounts is an okay word to use, came up shallow enough, a fishing industry developed from many nations, not just Australia and New Zealand, but there were Japanese fisheries, and Norwegian ones, and Russian ones, all there trawling the bottom. And the corals and the rock are quite sharp and overhung, and occasionally would hang up the fishing gear. And we found some of it. And boy, is that a scary moment when you're in the ROV. You can imagine a fishing net that's got some buoyancy to it. So it's weighted down to the bottom, but floating up above the bottom a little bit, about 10 meters or so, 30 feet above the bottom. And you are driving a vehicle that's got a long tether attached back up to the boat. And if you get caught in that net, game over, right?
Oh, my.
That vehicle is now staying on the bottom of the ocean. And so the fishing gear is something that we were always worried about. And in those areas that we knew fishing had happened, we had just had to go a lot more slowly. So not so much shipwrecks, but certainly fishing gear wrecks.
Mm-hmm. Mary is next from Madison. Hi, Mary.
Oh, hello. What an interesting show. You're speaking with somebody who did a lot of diving off of Monterey for many happy years. And I wanted to mention a remarkable DVD we had taken out several months ago by Werner Herzog. The title, I believe, is Close Encounters at the Top of the World. It's about the people living in Antarctica who dive in the Ross Sea in McMurdo Sound. And I did not realize until I took it out that it features a great deal of this Arctic diving and the interesting life forms they're finding in what you would assume would be a barren environment. It's not at all. But I was hoping your guest could speak in a general way about the future he sees for our oceans. Since every form of life has an impact, it's never been clear at all to many of us as to whether anything really can be done about the human impact or whether that's simply one more thing to deal with, like animals that overgraze an area. I certainly have noticed, switching topics one last time, that when we're buying fish at the store, for many years now, we've been buying scraps of fish. if you've lived on the ocean as many years as I did, I've noticed what small pieces of fish are now for sale. It can't be good. So perhaps he could speak a little, if he's familiar with the film, about the difference in the kind of diving people are doing right now and also what he sees as the general future for the oceans down the road. Thank you for a great show.
Thanks for the call.
Yeah, thank you for the call. And I can try to do both of those. I haven't seen the film, but I do know a little bit about these Arctic and Antarctic divers. And they bring back fantastically beautiful pictures for what seems to be totally insane risks, diving underneath the ice in Antarctica. But I've seen some of these documentaries. I haven't seen the specific Herzog film. One of the things that you'll see down there are these deep-sea corals. Something that I think people get confused about with corals is, wait, don't they need light? Why can they be down there in the deep ocean? And don't they need to be warm? How can they be growing in Antarctica? The first point about that is just that the corals that you know and love about the Great Barrier Reef or the Caribbean are actually a symbiotic relationship between an animal, the coral, and an algae that live literally in their cells, in their tissue. And the algae does photosynthesis and feeds the coral carbon that it fixes from photosynthesis, and the coral provides the algae a home in the waves but up in the sunlight. If you get rid of the algae, which is what coral bleaching is, you sometimes hear about this, if you get rid of the algae, the coral itself is just a polyp. It's a sessile filter feeder on the bottom of the ocean, and it has no temperature or depth tolerance. It can grow anywhere around the ocean, and so we know of lots and lots of corals that can grow in Antarctica. In terms of what do I see as the future for our oceans, I think that there are absolutely choices that we can make as humans and as consumers that would have a more beneficial effect on our oceans. And I think that this isn't just about the oceans. I think it does come back to thinking about CO2 and what does our atmospheric carbon dioxide future look like. If we are able to stabilize atmospheric carbon dioxide concentrations or even bring them down, I think it would do a world of good both for our oceans and for the overall temperature of the planet.
Hmm. We had a very well-known oceanographer with us a couple months ago, I don't know when it was. Time goes so fast. But she said something remarkable that she thinks there's so much junk in the ocean now that she doesn't even eat fish anymore.
Yeah. So my wife is half Japanese, and if we go out for dinner, it's always for sushi. And it was very hard on us to not be able to go out for sushi, especially when she was pregnant, for these very reasons of mercury buildup in the higher species, especially in things like tuna and swordfish.
Uh-huh.
There is no doubt that we are having an impact in these sorts of ways on the ocean. The specific example of fish are fish scraps. Particular fisheries have been completely overfished. The Grand Banks in the North Atlantic are one example. There are also heroic examples of management agencies coming in before it's too late and figuring out ways to manage that fishery a little bit better so that you can actually eat the delicious fish and still have a viable ecosystem down there. But in terms of the metal pollution and the bacterial pollution in the fish, I wouldn't go so far as to say that we don't eat fish at all, but it's certainly a growing concern, I agree.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call, Mary. Let's go next to Philip from Ashland. Oh, wait a second. I got something wrong here. I didn't get rid of Mary. There we go. Now we go to Philip. Hi, Philip.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Thanks for taking my call. I had a question for your guest. He had been referring to sewage and putting it in the oceans a bit ago. I was wondering if he was aware of that Penn State study where by interjecting a little bit of electricity into a solution that they had microbes that were producing hydrogen at an energy level of about one-tenth of what it would otherwise cause that it would take to crack hydrogen out of water.
So that's a very interesting question. I don't know this particular study, but I think that the sort of heart of the question, or the essence of the question, is fantastically important, which is how is it that we can use some of the natural aspects of the ocean to solve some of the problems without then hurting the ocean itself? And you might worry about putting electrodes into the seawater and what this might do. But there are certain parts of the carbon cycle that the ocean really has it down pat over land plants. that might help us with this CO2 problem.
Well, can I interject one second?
Sure, go ahead.
What they were suggesting, though, instead of using this, basically turn all of your sewage treatment plants into energy production facilities.
I think that that is thermodynamically just right, as long as you count up the energy correctly. So the point being that these algae are fossil fuels. So they're not fossil, but they are biofuels, and they are already fixed carbon that have trapped the energy of sunlight from photosynthesis to make their tissue. And if you burn them, you're releasing that energy from the sunlight. You're also releasing the CO2 that comes along with it. The question, of course, becomes...
They weren't burning it. They were just using a little bit of a boost that caused them to behave differently in...
I see what you're saying. So that they were then producing more hydrogen than they normally would have. Is that what you're saying? It was part of their metabolism as opposed to them dying and decaying to hydrogen.
Are you still there, Philip?
Oh.
I don't know where he is.
So it's an interesting point about whether we could use some of the fantastic metabolisms that are in the ocean already, things that are hydrogen producers, to speed them up. A number of your callers have asked a version of the next point, right, which is, well, when we do that, don't we mess something else up? And that's almost always true, mm-hmm. that there are unintended consequences to things like this. But I personally see the CO2 problem as so important for society that we need to have all of these sorts of ideas on the table. And to the degree that hydrogen gas is an alternative energy source, it is also part of the CO2 problem. And so I think that your caller is barking up the right tree there.
Thanks very much for the call. Here's an email that's come in. Take any part of this you want. The most interesting or most unique things that you found on the trip. It sounds like it was pretty much everything, but take that where you want.
Yeah, I would say I can list a couple things specifically, but, you know, I always wax philosophical about this stuff, so I'll go more general.
How can you not?
So let's see. This trip was all the things that 33 days at sea can be. It was exhilarating and exhausting and frustrating and transcendent. I mean, it was on all over Christmas and New Year's, of course. It was incredibly exciting. I would say that some of the more fantastic stuff was just being down at 4,000 meters. The control room van was packed that day when we landed on the seafloor for the first time at 4,000 meters, because you'd never seen. And that
yes.
sense of discovery just right. imbued the crews. And these moments where you knew, man, these are going to be the first eyeballs ever, right? At least human
right.
eyeballs, to see what's going on down there. And those are just fantastic moments.
I'm sure.
For me personally, we were looking for these particular sorts of corals, these scleractinia, and especially the fossil ones. And we had in our head a sort of method for how to find them, how to use the maps of the seafloor to better predict where to find them. And we were in the process of refining those. And the moments where you would come over a big rock and then looming out of the distance on a 10-foot-high wall would be all of the corals that you were trying to see in just the place that you would sort of hope they were going to be. That felt pretty darn good.
I'm sure it
just
did.
To feel like, yeah, we're actually starting to get a grip on where these guys live and how their habitats actually work.
Right.
There was one very disappointing moment along those lines, right? Science is not, you know, all a bowl of cherries in this sense. That it was very important to us to try and find corals as deep as we possibly could, because you get down into the deepest water masses, those are the ones that store carbon dioxide most effectively on these glacial and the glacial timescales. And the corals ran out at 2,400 meters. We never found any living or fossil scleractinia deeper than 2,400 meters. We found other kinds of corals, but not the particular ones we were looking for. And it happened very, very consistently in the three different areas that we looked, that as you came up in the water column, start down at 3,000 and start rising up, at 2,500 there's nothing, at 2,400 there's nothing, and then at 2,385, bang, living and dead would come in together. And that is trying to tell us something, and I don't know what it is yet. But it was an amazingly consistent observation. But it was disappointing that we're not going to be able to sample the deepest parts of the ocean at the last glacial maximum.
Well, let us know what you find out in the months ahead, please.
Absolutely.
Great. Thank you so much for being with us. It was a great hour. I really enjoyed it.
Well, thank you for doing the interview. I really appreciate it.
Our guest just returned, just a few hours off the plane in the boat from this remarkable journey, Dr. Jess Adkins from the California Institute of Technology. And this is the website to go to. It's www, of course, Science Image, all together, scienceimage.cisro, CSIRO.AU. And you'll be able to see some images of things that nobody's ever seen before. Isn't that something to have that kind of work? You see things nobody's ever seen before. First human to see this. Okay, well, that's it for today. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Thanks to Rob Schroeder for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee on Earth. And we'll want to thank all of you for calling, for your interest in these kinds of programs. I'll be with you again next Monday for All Things Political. We'll have a lot to talk about at the rate things are happening in Washington, so keep your ears on what's going on, and we'll talk about it on Monday. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.